Hei og velkommen til podcasten Frilanslivet, en podcast av meg, Hanna von Bergen og min kollega Kristina Skreiberg. Vårt mål med denne podcasten å være en faglig og inspirerende kanal for alle dere som jobber for dere selv I medie, kunst og kulturbransjen. Ukens annonsør regnskapsprogrammet Fiken. Akkurat som oss brenner fiken for at flere frilansere og små bedrifter skal lykkes, og bak fiken så står mennesker som selv har erfart hvor vanskelig regnskap kan være, og de har derfor laget en løsning som gjør det lett å føre regnskapet selv. Så lett at både Kristina og jeg har brukt det I flere år, og helhjertet anbefaler det til andre frilansere. Vil du prøve fiken gratis I 30 dager? Gå inn på fiken.no. I will continue in English since our guest this week is from Finland. Documentary film director and producer John Webster is here in Oslo with his documentary The Happy Worker or How Work Was Sabotaged, which is being shown at the film festival Oslo Pix this week. John is 55 years old and has directed and produced documentaries for over 25 years. He has an MA in documentary filmmaking from the University of Art and Design in Helsinki and has won numerous awards both nationally and internationally for his independent films. And today's talk will center around the topic of John's latest documentary, The Happy Worker, or How Work Was Sabotaged. This movie explores the question, what's wrong with the way we work? This documentary focuses mainly on office workers, but many freelancers can probably relate to certain aspects in relations to clients, projects, or just the dread of ending up in a 9-to-5 job like the one portrayed in the movie. I'm looking forward to hearing John's take on what is causing this unengagement and unhappiness. What surprised him in making this film? And what can we as freelancers learn in order to stay happy in our jobs? Hi, John, and welcome to Oslo.
Hi, Hannah, thanks.
Nice to have you here.
Great to be here.
Where did this idea for this movie come from?
Well, it started in 2018, and I was looking around for my next project, and it, like over a number of years, it had struck me like how many of my close friends, highly educated, highly motivated, critical thinkers, who loved what they did, but absolutely hated their workplace. And they were, it wasn't just like, a little unhappy. Many of them were deeply unhappy. So it, there was a couple of really interesting. There's an article in the Guardian by Andre Spicer, who's in the film as well, who's called "Business Bullshit," and then David Graeber, the anthropologist, had a book come out the following year called "Bullshit Jobs," and both of those were fairly instrumental in like really drawing me into the subject.
And in the beginning of this documentary, the narrator lists several characteristics of a normal workday for many. But the points listed are actually from a manual for sabotage used during the Second World War. Tell us a bit about this sabotage manual.
Well, this was actually something that Andre Spicer referenced. And the examples that was striking were, things that were known to make work less productive and people are more unhappy. So they were interrupt work as often as possible, hold meetings when there's something more important to be done, always refer decisions to committees and make sure the committee's at least six people, make sure that three people have to approve anything when one would be enough and improve paperwork. Those are just some of the examples. And for most people working in an office, that's a normal day in the office.
Yeah. And this was actually a manual distributed to kind of, for people to sabotage.
Yeah, this was a manual called the Simple Sabotage Field Manual. I think I got the name right. Published in 1944, and it was made by the then CIA, the OSS, and it was dropped in Europe to people working for the resistance. And so, you know, it has how to blow up bridges and all sorts of telecom disrupt communications. But then there's a whole section of work. And it's just, it just right jumps right at you. And I've, when we first pitched the film to, that was, you know, what we use. And it's just so striking that that could be, that we've known for over 80 years exactly what not to do, and we go ahead and do it.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people can relate to this with a lot of meetings, paperwork, all decisions kind of has to go through a lot of people. People have to approve things. And yeah, it's almost like bureaucracy, you could say, or kind of making the process of getting things done much harder.
Yeah, it's also termed as a neocracy. So it's all the things that we used to laugh at in the Soviet Union about having all these jobs, really, literally really doing nothing just to have jobs and boost the unemployment rate, which in a sense is not all that bad either. But we're still doing it under the kind of illusion of like being very market oriented and very being like very efficient, etc. And I think in the last 4 years, it has really struck me just how inefficient work is in big organizations. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, because is that kind of observation, the bigger the organization, the kind of more of this happens? Or what have you observed?
It's a problem of even a moderately sized company. If you've got a pizzeria, you don't have that problem because you don't have this organizational problems and work culture problems that come up in bigger organizations. And what it does is what I focused on. A lot of the film is focused on, of course, was what it does to people. And how unhappy they were. And the figures are quite striking. I think the latest figures globally are about 19% of people are actually active, what's called actively engaged. So they come to the office, they do it like they do their best, they put in a good day's work. And around 60% of people are disengage, which means, yeah, they'll do their job, but if a better job comes up, you know, then they'll maybe move. They're neither like moved either way. And then there's a group called actively disengaged, which is again about 19%. And they're not just unhappy, they are so unhappy that they're actually sabotaging the work of the people who are trying to put in a good day's work.
Yeah, so they're working against their employee.
They're actually working against their employee. And this is globally, those are globally the figures, but it varies a little bit from country to country. You know, I think Norway, this is 2017 figures, but in Norway it's like 17 are engaged, 75% can't.
Yeah, it's still very, yeah, very low. And these are quite some depressing facts. This research that you talk about is a global survey done by Gallup, which they do quite often. And I actually went to Gallup's webpage from the State of Global Workplace 2022 report, where it says, quote, living for the weekend, watching the clock tick, work is just a paycheck, unquote. And these are the mantras of most global workers. And they say, Gallup says, most would say that they don't find their work meaningful, don't think their lives are going well, or don't feel hopeful about their future. And this is quite dystopian knowledge, considering our work is a third of our life. You have been working on this movie how many years?
4 years now.
4 years. What has your research and your insight from making this documentary shown in terms of what has gone wrong?
Well, I'd like to approach two things. One is like how we organize work, working culture. That's one thing which is wrong. Many things have gone wrong. There's another point too, which is also an important thing, which is very often not talked about, is what it does to people. The amount of unhappiness and specifically burnout. Let's start with burnout, because it is such a big problem that nobody talks about. So burnout, there are many different studies, but pretty much one in two people working in the office or working have experienced burnout symptoms. Millennials, and this was Deloitte, I think, millennials, 80% of millennials have experienced some form of burnout, either during their studies or then in working life. And there are like three, what Christina Maslach, who's a pioneer of burnout, she calls, there are three dimensions of burnout. So one is like exhaustion. And exhaustion is caused by just, burnout in general is just caused by like daily things that really like just stress you out, you know. And for each person, it's like very individual. And its most extreme form, which most people, you know is this exhaustion. And I've met lots of people with who have you know, reached that point. And it's amazingly physical. I mean, young people who wake up and they're literally, you know, in the morning and they're literally paralyzed. I mean, panic attacks, feeling that they're having a heart attack, a stroke, things like, it's basically your body saying, that's enough. You know, you can't take it anymore. Then there's other, perhaps, you know, less physical, but still all the same important. One is cynicism, which you get a lot at the workplace, the cynical office worker, your cynical mate. And cynicism really is also a form of defense. You know, you don't expect much from the world. And so when the world doesn't give you much, well, you're not surprised. And then there's inefficacy, feeling ineffective, feeling that I'm really not doing my job properly. You feel bad about yourself. These are all dimensions of burnout. The problem is that nobody talks about it. There's this in the office culture and the working culture, there's this wall of silence. I've come across the word theater, charade. Everybody's going around, you know, pretending that everything is okay. And when you're pretending it okay, there's nobody that you can really talk to. And very early on in making the film, one, again, transformative experience was going to a burnout support group. And there were about six people in it, all young women. And it was striking just, you know, it wasn't just exhaustion because it's not talked about. People who reach that point feel it's my fault. I did it. I couldn't take it. I wasn't strong enough. And more than that, it's existential. I'm not the person who I thought I was.
Yeah, your identity.
You lose your identity. You believe, like, I've been telling myself a lie all this time. And such an existential, like, storm, you know, it can't be dealt with in, like, 2 weeks of holiday and a yoga course. So it really is, and it's also so unfair because it's a product of a toxic working environment. I mean, say if you were in a factory and you got a rash or breathing difficulties, you would know that, you know, nobody in the factory would say, well, you're getting that rash because you're just not strong enough.
Yeah, your lungs can't take it.
Your lungs can't take it. Go and get some mountain air, then come back. No, in a factory, people know that, okay, well, that's something wrong here. In the office, there's not that. Even though today we're talking more about burnout, but it's still going back to the individual.
Yeah, and she kind of mentions the woman you're talking about.
Christina Maslach.
Yeah, she, Christina Maslach has researched and identified kind of key causes of workplace burnout, which I've written down, but do you remember them as well?
Well, I think you're talking probably about the key, like, six areas that are important to people in work.
Yeah.
So just a word about Christina Maslach. So she's a pioneer out of Berkeley. She's a professor at Berkeley, or used to be a professor at Berkeley. She has this wonderful book called The Truth About Burnout. Very short, but in 4 years of reading about this subject, I can't recommend that too often, because it's a very easily read and easy to understand, and it very beautifully like captures, first of all, what's important to us people at work, but also what one can do about it. So another thing about burnout is people keep on asking, well, why me? They see around them other people that they're okay, but why is it me? Well, people are individuals, and there are some things that are more important to some than are to others. And so, and again, there's lots and lots of really good research about how to have a good working environment. The problem is that management doesn't seem to take it on board. We'll get to that. But so Christina and many others also have identified through research six areas that are important to people that contribute to how happy you are at work or how unhappy. So the first is workload, obviously, like, you know, too much and you're not too happy. But the second is control. So that's that you have the tools to do your job, you have the time to do the job, you have, you know, you have that feeling of like in some way you can sort of in charge of how you do it. And often, like with workload, high workload is not a problem if you have high control. The problems come when you have a high workload and very low control. So the third is reward, which is not just about money, because money, of course, is part of it, but it's also that feeling of you see the result of your work. You also get feedback from your colleagues or from your bosses. You all the time have this feeling of like, I did something and it had a result. Community. Then there's fairness and values. So those are the six areas. But for some people, things are more important than others. For example, the introvert at the office doesn't give a damn about community. Could be to that person, it's like it's value, or it could be fairness to that person. Another person, for example, control might be very important. Say, you know, they got small kids or they got parents who got sick, so they need to have control about how they do their jobs. And so if you have, say, you know, one of those areas or many of those areas, but you say one of those areas that's a problem at that workplace, say fairness. Those people that fairness isn't something really that they really care about, they're going to be, you know, it's not going to affect them so much as for those for whom fairness is a huge thing. Or control, for example, for the person who really needs that time to look after the parent or the child. So, yeah,
or just likes doing things their way.
Doing things their way, yes, yes, that too. That too is so they're very individual.
Yeah, and I think freelancers that is listening to this talk can kind of relate also probably to certain aspects of this. That when you work for yourself, you might have a huge workload, but you also have a high degree of control. Hopefully, if you have good enough income, so you can choose a bit what jobs to take and how to do them, etc. And a lot of people that we have talked to. And kind of in service we have done and research we have read, is this also kind of need of community, which a lot of freelancers lack or need to, or feel they could have even more of. So they might have, you know, a co-working space or a group of freelancers doing the same. So you can kind of exchange knowledge or support each other.
Yes, that's exactly right about freelancers. As a freelancer myself, you know, for 30 years, workload is seldom a problem just because one has so much control. You're your own boss. Reward, yeah, that's pretty much under control in a sense that, well, you do hope you get feedback from the work that you do. Fairness, value, yeah, well, you decide that's good. But community indeed is a big problem, or it's say can be a big problem, is that if that's what you need. And I think it goes for freelancers too, as well as anybody working in a 9-to-5 job, is that, and it's helped me now also during these 4 years when I've been stressed, and when something stresses me out, I like try and take a step back and say, okay, why is this doing this? What is the problem? Is it a fairness issue here? Is it a control issue? And that sort of helps me like realize and process it and realize, okay, why why that's important to me. Control is like super, super important to me.
Yeah, me
I mean, it sounds like, you know, I'm a control freak, but no, I mean, I'm a freelancer and I do this the way, you know, and I don't have a regular salary and it's all like project based and, you know, it's very uncertain, etc. But at least I get to do the things and live the things that, you know, I'm passionate for. If one's starting out to become a freelancer, I think one does have to think about, well, who am I? What is my personality? Is community important to me? Is value, fairness, things like that? I want to just pick up a little bit of one thing that you said about this. You quoted Gallup and this meaninglessness or meaningfulness. Again, a transformative moment in this project was for me in David Graeber's book, Bullshit Jobs. And he talks about a child psychologist. I think his name Claus, could be, I'm wrong, but turn of last century, one of the first child psychologists. And he talks about this moment in anybody who has, you know, small babies, or have worked with small babies, they know about 9 months, babies do is they pick up something and they drop it. And then they wait for the adult to come and pick it up. Then they drop it again, and the adult comes, and they drop it, and they come, and it's like they go on for hours. And so this is like a transformative moment in each one of our lives. It's that moment when you realize that you can have an effect on the world. I drop this pen and it has the effect that the adult comes and picks it up, or I knock this thing over. And it's amazing, like realization in our lives. It happens before we can talk. It happens before we can walk. We realize that we're not just an amoeba floating around, you know, in water. We can have an effect. And I think that's what work is too. It's whatever your work is. It's you do it because you want to feel that what you did had an effect. And so much of working life these days, and specifically office work, is you don't see what effect it has. You don't know why you're doing this, like, or if it has any meaning at all. And one of the saddest things about our working culture is that it robs people of that, like, very basic human need.
Ukens annonsør, det banktjenesten Folio. Med stiftemaskinen fra Folio så kan du på under 5 minutter opprette ditt eget AS. Her får du gjort hele jobben med å stifte ditt eget aksjeselskap på ett sted. Du mottar bedriftskonto med en gang, noe som hos tradisjonelle banker kan ta ukesvis, og Folio loser deg gjennom noen enkle steg, og du mottar SMS når du må gjøre noe. Superenkelt! Sjekk ut stiftemaskinen.no for mer info.
Christina Maslach talks about, you know, in the last decades, we've made huge, you know, advances in ergonomics. We realize that the human body is built in a certain way to be more efficient. You know, we have better lighting, better working spaces. In the same way, we should understand that we need better ergonomics of the mind. So we have ways in which people work together and make that more efficient. Because that's where the money really is made. There's a wonderful example about, again, you know, research, how long we've known how to make people, you know, to work more productive. Now, there was this experiment in the 1920s called the Hawthorne experiment. In the 1920s and 1930s were like a really scientific era of management. You know, you think of Charlie Chaplin and modern times. You've got scientists trying to get the extra, you know, out of the workers. So he had this factory, and I forget what the factory does, but it's not important. But they wanted to know what effect lighting and air conditioning had on productivity. So they took this factory, and they gradually increased the air conditioning, and they gradually made the lighting better. And as they did that, productivity went up. So then they thought, okay, at what point, what's the sweet spot where we have good productivity, but we're not spending so much on electricity? So they started taking the air conditioning down and the lighting down, all the way down to where it was in the beginning. And when they looked at productivity, it was still high. So they wondered, what's going on here? And when they looked closely at it, it was because on the factory floor, there were scientists or members of the scientific group asking factory workers, how do you find this lighting? How do you, you know, can you work better here? Like, what do you think of the air conditioning? So all it took to make productivity high was for those doing the work to feel that somebody in management cared that they could do the work well and to the best of their abilities.
Well, yeah, that's
100 years ago. And we still learned nothing.
Yeah, it's a very clear example. I was a bit curious because as a freelancer, what made you want to create a documentary about kind of modern day office workers?
I think in the documentaries, or my documentary filmmaking, I mean, documentary filmmaking, it takes, you know, it takes 2 to 3 years usually to make a film. So a lot of the time, or all the time really, it's not a question about just making a film. It's like, how am I going to spend my life? And I tend to, I look for subjects that I really care deeply about, and because that's going to keep me going for the next 3 or 4 years, and through all the hardships and through, you know, the difficulties in making a film. So I think in any project, I have to find something which I feel, you know, this could be better. or where I see that people are like unnecessarily, like it's an unnecessary problem. And I think working culture is a totally unnecessary problem. And it's also, when it comes to burnout, it's a very unfair problem, deeply unfair problem. So I think there's this activist in me. I think I wouldn't make documentaries, or big part of documentary, of course, is, you know, cinema and filmmaking. But for me, an important aspect is like, you know, can it change something somewhere?
And what do you hope to kind of change with this film?
I hope people will see it and they'll realize, wait a minute, I'm not alone. I'm not alone with these feelings. That in here, in my own office, you know, there's at least half of us think this way. So they'd start talking. I think talking is, or communications is key in this. Because once people start talking and once people realize that they're not alone with thinking that this is messed up, that perhaps they'll do something about it. Again, it's a weird, weird culture of charades and silence. For example, you know, you have a town hall meeting where you have somebody in management or consultant, they come in and they spout all sort of bullshit about accelerating transformation and all sorts of buzzwords. Nobody knows, you know, what the hell they're saying. And you've got this room full of like highly educated people who've been trained for critical thinking, and they're all sitting there just silent, just taking it in. And I'd like to see that happen in a factory. In a factory, you know, you got a consultant coming now spouting bullshit. No way are people going to be silent. But somehow this, the office makes us silent, and that's something that needs to be broken, absolutely. And I hope also management would take a, you know, money, look at money. I mean, keep on going about money and the bottom line and things like that, but really, I mean, just look at how wasteful you have a situation where often, like, you know, the payroll is the biggest expense that you have. You've got a payroll where only like 20% of people are actually like being efficient. It's ridiculous. Gallup estimates that the cost of bad management is $7 trillion a year. Not quite sure how they get to this figure, but I do believe it's, if you think that the payroll is the biggest is the biggest outlay for many companies. And if you're only having 20% of them actually like doing productive work, you can pretty much quickly, you know, calculate how much money you are losing.
And when I watched this movie and also kind of read the statistics, I was thinking, ah, but maybe it's like that, you know, maybe in the States, or it's easy to think that it's not a global issue. Or maybe it's like some countries or some like the Western world. But actually, like, the statistics are the same across, you know, the States, Kenya, France, Japan, Brazil, Sweden. So it's really kind of all over the place.
Yeah, there's some surprising statistics there. I mean, America, people are like, more people are engaged in the US than they are in Europe. One of the worst countries, I mean, it's up there with South Korea and Japan in unhappiness, is France and Italy. It's been interesting now during COVID, of course, to see. I think one of the big things in COVID has been and why people are much happier, or why right now, for example, it's very difficult, or has been difficult, to get people to go back to the office, because obviously people would rather work from a cupboard in their bathroom than go back to the office. And I think that says something about, there must be something wrong if that is there. But I think it has to do with this aspect of control. You control more better, like how you work, how much you work, what you do, like how you do it and what hours. You save on commute. I think also it may be that a lot of people could do their work in less hours than they have to sit at the office. And so why go to the office and sit there, just pretend to work? Again, it's, why do we have this culture? Where does it come from of being, we have to put in 8 hours? You're not a proper human being if you don't put in your 8 hours, you do put in 12 hours or so.
As we talked about, this movie is very much about kind of the aspects of a modern day office work. As a freelancer, what can we kind of take away from this movie in order to try and stay happy in our jobs?
Well, I think freelancers, and it's really hard. I know what it's like, and it's, you know, you don't know when the money's coming in. But you have this aspect of, you're doing what you believe in most of the time. Sometimes you have to take those jobs that, like, you don't believe in at all, but at least, you know, it pays the bills so that you can do the things that you want. Again, I think I quote David Graeber in that one of the most destructive things for human beings is this feed. Well, one is loss of meaning. He quotes Dostoevsky, you know, who was sent to a hard labor camp. And like that, like, the worst form of punishment was not working hard. The worst was, and I think it was in Dostoevsky, but so one day they dug a ditch. The next day they filled that same ditch in. The day after they dug a new ditch, they filled it in. So day after day, you're doing something that you know is, or you feel is absolutely pointless. And so that loss of meaning, again, going back to that example of us at about 9 months, is a major thing that goes against who we are, you know, as these human beings. The other, and I suppose it has to do with meaning, but it has this, you know, living a lie, this feeling that you're living a lie. So that lie can be, this company says one thing, but it's doing another. It can be like, I'm not this person who I have to be at work. All these things where you feel that you're not, you know, you are living a lie. And yeah, sometimes, if it's, you know, if you're a scam artist, you're living your own lie. The worst is when you're actually living somebody else's lie. And I think that's often things that happen in the workplace. And it's made, obviously, it's made worse by people not talking. And I think if people talked already, that aspect of it would be a lot better, because it's just made worse by the feeling that I'm alone and thinking that I'm living a lie. Mm. So what can freelancers take away? Well, they can, I think they can know that in many, many organizations, even if you've got a good pay and you've got a regular pay, it does not make you happy, because that's not what makes people make people happy in the long run. It can be a lot of time also, like a large compensation can be a compensation for all the other things that you don't have. But in the long run, I think, and studies bear this out, it's not a key to happiness.
Akkurat nå til alle hjemmefiksere som liker lave priser. En slangetrommel fra Gardena på 20 meter til vanntette 499 kroner. Ingenting kan stoppe deg nå.
You've been doing documentaries for over 25 years?
30, actually.
Or 30 years.
Yeah.
What kind of got you into making movies, documentaries?
Well, I started... I got my first camera when I was 12, and I started photographing from then. And then I was supposed to be a shipbuilding engineer. I always wanted to build ships. And so, you know, I'm very technically minded, and that's what I thought I'd be. Then I had, this is the long story, but I mean, I had a wonderful arts teacher at school who said, like, Webster, you don't really have any talent, but your talent is to convince people that you have talent. And I think she was right. I'm very good at pitching. I'm very good at selling film ideas, and I think I'm better at it than actually making the films, but perhaps that's another story. So then I got more interested in this idea of that, you know, to how to take the camera that perhaps one step further, which was to have sound and moving in images. And of course, like, I was really interested in people and human, how we fit into the world. So then I applied for the film school, and they had just set up a documentary strand, and I got in and then started making films.
And what is it kind of about this format of documentary that you find appealing, or that kind of fits you as a person?
Well, I've never made any fiction. I've made radio fiction, which is great fun, super, super fun. I just love radio because you can, you know, or I suppose podcast it would be today, but where you can create any world. You can put things in any order that you want and create these amazing spaces. But no, I've never made fiction films. I think for me, the fascination is that in fiction film, whatever is of beauty or truth, or you have to put into the piece. So through good writing, good direction, sound design, acting, production value. Whereas documentary, whatever is of truth and beauty, you have to find from reality. And I think that for me is endlessly fascinating in just going into a subject. And you know, I often like follow people for a long time. I'll do like long research, like 6 months at least, and you really get to know people. And then just like finding those moments that like speak to us all. And I think that's, yeah, I've done it for 30 years, and I just like, yeah, I hope I get to do it for maybe not another 30, but 20.
And kind of what aspects of your freelance life creates happiness for you?
I think it are those moments when the camera is rolling, the sound is rolling, and there's that moment in front of the camera, and you know this, wow, this moment. They're not, during a film shoot, they're not that many. That creates happiness. I love being with people and like working with images. And then when you get something like that, it feels like this treasure. And I want more of this treasure. Then, as in any work, it's at every stage that you are, you're always dreaming about the next stage. So when you like researching, you're like, oh, I wish I could start filming. And then you're filming it, oh, I wish I could start editing. So you kind of look forward to that. And then, yeah. Yeah, that gives me happiness. And I think happiness too, of course, because I do want it to have like some effect somewhere when I know like it's, you know, it's changed something somewhere. I mean, how many people it has to change, you know, more than me, you know, one more than me is already a lot. So, and I think that's something that many filmmakers and documentary filmmakers, you know, always talk about is that what difference does this make? Mm-hmm. But we're going back to that question of meaning and like impact on the world, which I think everybody does.
And in this movie, I like one thing is the kind of effect for people viewing the movie, but also in the documentary, you have this group of individuals kind of telling their story of how they have been unengaged or have experienced a burnout in their workplace, and they're from different places in the world. You can also see kind of what effect it has on them as a group to be able to share and kind of, tell their story to each other, how helpful it is for them as well. So I think that's a nice kind of reflection for the people that's been part of it as well. It looks like it had a really big effect.
I think so. Yes, we had, so as part of this movie, we had six people take part in a group therapy workshop. And they were six people from different parts of the world working for different industries who'd all experienced burnout in some form. And so they kind of share their experiences during the film. But I think you're exactly right there. I think the biggest thing for them was just to be able to share, because burnout, it's so lonely. It's so lonely, and people think it's just them. Mm. And it's not. It's the effect of a toxic environment, a toxic working environment. It's a management issue, not a worker issue.
Yeah. And have you changed anything about how you work after this period of 4 years and kind of deep diving into this material?
Well, it has helped me in moments when I feel like I think to myself, why am I so stressed about this thing? Why am I getting like worked up about this? And then I try and take a step back and look at it from these Maslach's six areas and like say, okay, I'm stressed about this because this ultimately is a control thing, and I'm really sensitive to control things. And I hope everybody else could do that too, and think about themselves, like which area of those six, workload, control, reward, community, fairness, and value, which are they particularly sensitive to? You know, and that's the thing that might be really getting to them at the workplace. And it helps for that feeling certainly of like, why me? And those who are in burnout or getting there, that's the question they always ask. Why me? Why am I feeling like this? Why is nobody else? And it's because they're particularly sensitive to that area that's messed up in the workplace. Another thing that I think, and it has to do with, so I have two boys, they're 25 and 21. The 25-year-old is already studying, so he kind of knows what he wants to do. And the 21-year-old is kind of thinking about it. And when he finished school and he wrote his matriculation exam, he was telling all what his friends were thinking of, and it was sort of depressing that those what is today considered a good job is exactly the same as like 35 years ago when I did. So it's law, medicine, commercial, and then maybe some engineering studies, but be a lawyer, be a doctor, you know, go into finance.
Be a documentary maker.
Yeah, no, it's not up there with the top four. And it's depressing because I think, and again, this is more of a subjective impression, but I think one of the most unhappiest groups that I've met, corporate lawyers.
Yeah.
Corporate lawyers. And I think it comes from, you know, the expectations versus reality.
Yeah, and it's interesting because in that kind of status, and kind of what you want or what people want to become as kind of their job. It's so much like money driven and status driven rather than if you kind of looked at all the data and looked at which group were the happiest. That would be super interesting to kind of see.
Well, I think what's relevant for freelancers is that truth that people are happiest when they're doing something where they feel that they are that they're naturally good at. That's really what makes people happy at work. You know, I got this. This is my thing. This is what I do naturally well. And if only at schools we would prepare kids more from that point of view. So imagine like when you're 15 or 16, I mean, you yearn to know, who am I? What am I like? What would that mean for work? So to be able to better prepare kids looking at like, okay, what's your personality? What are you good at? Like, what does that mean from your personality? What sort of areas you would be happier in and what you wouldn't? And because there's so little of that, and it's really crazy if I think how little time is spent on preparing young people for what is perhaps one of the most important decisions they're going to make in their life, and that's what are they going to do as a career? Yes, you know, there's more than just giving them a foundation for then further studies, which of course is good in its way too, but because there's not any preparation in what are you actually naturally good at, then people tend to gravitate to the school subjects that they were good at, because that's sort of, they felt that in that school subject, I was kind of good and like I enjoyed it, but that has a lot to do with how good the teacher is. And so it's not so much to do with the personality of that person. So I do wish in schools, and can you imagine how popular that would be if kids could really if effort would be put into teaching kids who they are and what that means for a job. I think we do gravitate to the things that we are like naturally good at, or we have a skill to do, because otherwise like we couldn't do it very long if we didn't have that. And I think the freelancers are kind of maybe blessed in that way, in that either they've had the backing from the home or their social, to like, okay, you can go for that. Or go for that, and that's okay. Or maybe they've done it, despite that. but I think for so many people, they are doing what they think is expected of them. And this is particularly, I think, a problem for young girls and young women. I think there's something in the way we bring up girls to... that their sense of self is so often, it seems to me, built on these like academic, getting top marks from everything. And that's where their sense of worth comes from. I don't know if it's, if it's still so strongly like a gender divide, but I do think, and I now during these four years, met a lot of people in burnout who were always like top of the class, always did what was expected of them, always did that. And it's difficult to keep up.
Yeah.
But for freelancers, I think freelancers are, yes, as a freelancer, you do get to do most days what you want to do. And most days you get to see the results of your work. And that is a luxury. Well, no, it shouldn't be a luxury. That is something that many people with a steady income do not get.
Yeah. Nice closing words. Thank you, John.
I don't know. It's a bit of a downer, but it's a bit of a downer. It should be.
We wish that for more people.
We wish that. Yeah, I sincerely wish that that more people who work in a steady job would every day see the results of what they did and feel that whatever they did, that it had some meaning somewhere.
Yeah. Thank you, John, for coming.
Thank you, Hannah.
Having this talk.
It's great being here.
Ha det bra.
Denne episoden laget I samarbeid med tilskudd fra Finsk-Norsk Kulturinstitutt. Finsk-Norsk Kulturinstitutt jobber for å styrke kulturutvekslingen mellom Finland og Norge. Instituttet fremmer samarbeid, dialog og mobilitet mellom finske og norske kunstnere, kulturaktører og organisasjoner, og produserer et mangfoldig program for et bredt publikum.